So my idea was to create something which would both support the teaching of theology in countries and contexts where library provision was poor, and then also offer the connections to theology for people in predominantly the Western world where its study is in retreat from the universities that we have.
You're listening to The Coffee Hour. I'm Sarah Gulseth. I have a really exciting story to share with you today of a theologian from Scotland that's visiting us today at the International Center, and we get to share his story today with you. Today's episode of The Coffee Hour is underwritten in part by Concordia University, Nebraska. You can learn more about Concordia University, Nebraska at cune.edu. Joining me today, Dr. Brendan Wolfe, Principal Editor of the St. Andrew's Encyclopedia of Theology. Welcome to the studio, Dr. Wolfe.
Thank you. It's a great pleasure to be here with you.
Yes, it is very exciting to have you here. We're recording this before the Concordia Seminary commencement ceremonies, and that's why you are here today at the LCMS International Center. And it's really a great joy to have you in studio to get to share what you do and some of your story and your interests. I find it very interesting what you're doing with theology. So let's talk about how you became interested in a deep study of theology. What really influenced you to enjoy this breadth and depth of theological study?
Well, there's two answers to that question and two routes by which it came about, I suppose. The first is that I acquired what one might think of as a gentleman's interest in theology by dint of the studies that I was doing, first as an undergraduate, where I read classics and great books. And I studied in St. Catharines, Ontario, my hometown, and had the benefit, of course, of being near the St. Catharines Lutheran Seminary and knowing many of the outstanding teachers and researchers there. And very influential in retrospect was a reading group organized by one of the philosophy faculty at the university for John Stevenson's book in the A Confessional Lutheran Dogmatics series on the Lord's Supper. Attending that reading group, which included people from multiple denominations and multiple scholarly backgrounds, I did my best not to say anything, just to listen quietly and learn. I think that was the best introduction to theology as an animating pattern of the mind that I could have had. And it built on all those fine connections I had already with the teachers and researchers there. The other story is that I then went to Oxford for a master's degree, which I chose to do in Indo-European historical linguistics, interested in reconstructing the languages that stand behind the languages that are spoken or written available to us. And I ended up specializing in the Gothic language, which was written down primarily in the fourth and fifth century in terms of our records. And the main source for the Gothic language is a translation of the New Testament, which was made in that period. Mm-hmm. It's one of the earliest translations of the New Testament. And so I had worked for my master's on very technical linguistic aspects of that translation, and realized that I wanted to go on working on the Gothic Bible, but wanted to broaden my approach. And there's a very hard limit on how much theology or history one can do in a linguistics degree, but no limit on how much linguistics can figure in a theology degree. So I moved into theology formally for my doctorate, also at Oxford. And that was to be able to get the full picture on that text.
Okay, yeah. What sorts of topics do you enjoy studying? It sounds like you have a wide range of things that you enjoy. What sorts of things do you like to really research and get into and learn how they connect?
Well, nothing is an unalloyed pleasure, of course. What I enjoy doing is an interesting way of putting it, but I have tried to be encyclopedic in order to be able to understand and contribute in a lot of different areas of theology, as one must with the encyclopedia that I edit. The things I'm working on now, maybe, are I published a book with two of my colleagues, Oliver Langworthy and Matthias Gassmann, last year, the Nicaea anniversary. Everyone was quite rightly talking about the Nicene faith. We decided to write about Arianism, the losing side, the heretics, trying to give the picture of the of those who rejected Nicaea the kind of nuance and depth that recent scholarship has been able to give the Nicene side. So it's not an apologia for Arianism or anything. It's not an attempt to bring back Arianism as a single category, but it is an attempt to hold together the traditions and links among the people who rejected Nicaea as a single, well, single is perhaps the wrong word, as a diverse but somehow connected group of people and doctrines. I also work on theology and the arts. I was prompted into that by reflecting on the art of the Reformation and the addition, common addition at the Reformation of text to images. So paintings or other forms of image, woodcuts, of course, which one might previously have seen without labels, without text of any kind after the Reformation, partially because of the prioritization of the word, partially because of slightly different attitudes to the arts, text became more and more common. And so I was interested in the cognitive effects of that text. There's stories that have been told by art historians for a long time about what text does to art. It diminishes its artistic value. It's a failure, people say, to trust in the power of art. I was interested in that claim, but I was also interested in the more positive side. Well, why does one do this? Why did an artist or why would an artist include text? So I started a project which I called Text and Image and worked with postdocs in psychology to devise experiments, in effect, where we took images and digitally manipulated them so that they did or did not include text. And when text, we put different texts in. Always, we were using religious imagery, mostly crucifixions, and so they were always scriptural texts that we added. And we just showed them to hundreds of people and got their feedback, got their impressions of what they were experiencing, and found that the text, whatever aesthetic effect it had on the quality of the art, it definitely helped to channel the spiritual response. And when the text was, in some sense, congruent with the image, it heightened that response. So an image of the crucifixion with the words, "Son of David, have mercy on us," draws a religious believer more quickly and deeply into prayer than just the text or just the image on their own. So that was a research area that got me working in theology and the arts more generally. As part of that, I sponsored an exhibition where I paired artists with, well, colleagues and I paired artists with theology students, then to reflect together on the concept of revelation and the artist-produced art, which we brought to St. Andrews and put on display with reactions from other academics and masterclasses from other artists. And since then, I've had another project in that area, which is winding up shortly. So that's the theology and the arts. And then I suppose I'd throw one more in, which is I became interested during the lockdowns, during pandemic times. I was thinking about the landscape of the part of Scotland in which I live, Fife, on the east coast, and thinking about how that landscape had been shaped over the generations by religion. And I don't know, I mean, there have been minimal other religions than Christianity represented in Fife in terms of buildings. So really, when I say religion here, I'm talking about Christianity, how it shaped the landscape and affected where the towns are, where the fields are, what the churches look like. And these things being inaccessible at the time, I started a project called Sacred Landscape, looking at that, documenting it, and trying to present coastal Fife as a landscape of faith in a very literal sense. So that project continues as well.
So interesting as you're talking about these things, especially the putting words with images, and how that has been a thing for artists throughout time. And even now today in my work with KFUO, putting words on top of images and posting them on social media, that is still something that I do. And specifically for that reason, to have people look at a picture and see the text and put them together and then have some devotional time, even if we're on social media, to know that that's actually something that makes sense. That's something that psychologically has the effect that we're after. That is so interesting to think about.
Well, and we see with the rise of what people call memes in the last, whatever it's been, 20 years, that again, this pairing of text and images has real power.
It does. Absolutely. Tell me more about what you learned with the landscape. How how does theology, how does religion shape, physically shape a landscape? That is such an interesting thing to research and to look at in where you live in Fife.
Well, there's sort of historical positives. Lands would have belonged to the church. St. Andrews itself had a cathedral in the Middle Ages, as well as several monastic foundations. And the cathedral chapter would have owned a great deal of land, and those monastic foundations would have had some as well. And so land that belonged to the church might have a different treatment from that in private hands and would orient itself towards different kinds of use. Sometimes one thinks of longer-term investment on the part of the church because it's thinking in centuries rather than the years and decades in which we mete out our lives. Location of churches vis-a-vis villages is an important factor in shaping the landscape. Churches are often end up, in Britain anyway, end up being close to the large house, the manor, or whatever you want to call it, which is sometimes at some remove from the village. So villagers then have certain paths that they're taking to church. Mm-hmm. Churches are sometimes moved when that's too great a distance, or the roads can be determined by this. These paths on a small scale are influential. St. Andrews in the Middle Ages, though, was a major pilgrimage site due to relics of St. Andrew being understood to be there. So pilgrimage in Fife is a major shaper of how people have related to the landscape. Highways and paths down the center of the county, bringing people from farther south. The points at which they crossed the Firth to get to Fife from Edinburgh are still important. But on the other hand, kind of fallen away were the small chapels at which one would give thanks for a successful crossing. So we see some of these things still reflected in the landscape, and some of them we have to reconstruct historically. The less positive side, I guess, would be that church attendance is not very high in Scotland. It's one of the most secular parts of Europe. Fife is one of the more secular parts of Scotland. You wouldn't necessarily know it in St. Andrews itself, but the surrounding area. And we probably would call a state church, but the national church maybe, the Church of Scotland, which is Presbyterian, has, in order to refocus its ministry on the proclamation of the gospel, as opposed to the maintenance of lots of historic buildings, has chosen to sell a very high proportion, up to 40% of its church buildings. And that's an enormous change in the landscape in all respects. In many villages, those church buildings will have been the only public space. Mm-hmm. And so this is it's a privatization of public space. It's a change in how Christianity is put in front of people's eyes. It's a break with history. It's an enormous shift, and it's happening right now. So that our project, having begun as one writing pilgrimage notes and a tourism brochure, has realized for many of the buildings we were writing epitaphs, and we've just had to react to that and pivot in what we do.
Yeah. We have more to talk about with Dr. Brendan Wolfe, principal editor of the St. Andrew's Encyclopedia of Theology, right after we take a quick break. You're listening to The Coffee Hour. I'm Sarah Golseth.
Are you looking to gain practical insights and spiritual encouragement in a format that fits your life? Discover the treasures of Christ-centered learning with Concordia University, Nebraska. Utilizing an online, self-paced learning platform, Concordia Nebraska's new Studia Vitae program will offer a non-credit continuing education courses featuring lifelong learning opportunities in a variety of focused areas. Courses begin in January 2026 and registration opens soon. Learn more at cune.edu/CEU. That's cune.edu/CEU.
Welcome back to The Coffee Hour. I'm Sarah Golseth. Joining me in studio is Dr. Brendan Wolfe, principal editor of the St. Andrew's Encyclopedia of Theology. And let's talk for a minute about St. Andrew's University. I don't know personally. I maybe know one person that has any kind of affiliation with St. Andrew's. Tell me about the university, the area where it is, and what you get to do there.
University of St. Andrews is the third oldest English-speaking university, founded in 1413. That makes it the oldest in Scotland. It's a small town. It's located in a small town, which, apart from the roughly 10,000 students, has about, I think, 16,000 permanent inhabitants. Mm-hmm. So it's right on the sea, beautiful cliffs, three splendid beaches. Everyone who's seen Chariots of Fire remembers the running scene on the beach. That's one of them, one of the St. Andrews spaces. It's, of course, also famous for golf. Golf evolves in Scotland on the links, the land that links the arable land and the beach or the sea, hence the name. So it's a beautiful place. Divinity or theology has been taught since the beginning of the university. It is, of course, one of the reasons to establish a university. It's the middle of the 16th century. Theology has been located within one college of the university, St. Mary's College, which was founded in the 1530s, has been in the same buildings all that time. That's where I get to work with excellent colleagues from all denominations. We teach an array of subjects, but are fundamentally committed to being a school of traditional Christian theology in the classic sense. I don't do very much teaching because I superintend this large encyclopedia, the St. Andrews Encyclopedia of Theology, which is open access, which means free, open access online encyclopedia of the whole field of theology.
Tell us how the idea for this encyclopedia started.
Came about in a few ways. Of course, there's always a prompt of hearing other people's ideas and thinking, no, not quite. I think it would be better done this way. But fundamentally, it was reflecting on what was good in academic theology and how it could be a service to the church, but how the best academic theology is often located in places which, as I've already said, are full of empty churches and declining attendance, while theological instruction in the wider world has many, many more students and far fewer resources. So there are libraries all over the world, of course, but their provision can be very, very meager, and in particular, connection to the most recent or most up-to-date material is often quite limited. So my idea was to create something which would both support the teaching of theology in countries and contexts where library provision was poor, and then also offer the connections to theology for people in predominantly the Western world where its study is in retreat from the universities that we have. So that could be students who, like me, had that kind of gentleman's interest in theology, but it could also be people studying adjacent disciplines, English, classics, history, who want to understand these theological concepts that they're encountering in their study or research.
Tell us about what the encyclopedia encompasses. I took a brief glance at it before we sat down, and I think I went, wow, tell us what it encompasses. What kinds of things could I find there?
We've published about 3 million words.
That's a lot.
We're still growing all the time. We have fat years and lean years when it comes to funding, so we sometimes grow quicker and sometimes less quickly. But the goal is to continue expanding until we are able to provide as broad and deep a picture of a theology as possible. It's the Christian, so the Christianity is by far the largest represented body of religious teaching in this encyclopedia, but there are separate sections for Buddhism, Hinduism, Islam, and Judaism as well. And what's distinct about our product and distinct both across those sections, but also within them, is that anything you read is going to be written from the perspective of faith. If you're reading an article in there on Lutheran theology, Lutheran ecclesiology, for example, you know it's written by someone for whom that's a live matter. It's a Lutheran. If you're reading something on Islamic teaching, you're not reading somebody else's caricature. You're reading something by a Muslim, or at least from the Islamic perspective. And that is a gift to understanding one another. It's not some kind of claim that everything is equally true. It's a claim that understanding proceeds best from the internal perspective. Those articles on other religions could be very helpful to Christian missionaries trying to understand the people to whom they're relating, but they should be equally helpful to a Muslim trying to understand his or her own tradition better. So the compass is very broad. The articles are generally organized conceptually as opposed to, say, historically. So we have many more articles on single concepts, which then trace their history through the ages, than we do on theology in the Middle Ages or something like that. We don't really do that kind of thing. But we're hoping for our next major expansion to be looking at some of the key figures of theology. So individuals, people who have contributed in important ways. We won't do biography, but it's another way to cut up, as it were, the whole body of knowledge. We've looked at concepts, now let's also look at people. That's not to say that we're done with concepts, though. If I make no pretense that the thing is complete or compendious at this stage. Lots of growing to do.
I'm sure there's always something new to research, new to find, something, some other question to ask, something else to really look into. What is it about this intersection of theology? You've mentioned arts. I know you love good literature, the classics, history, culture. What is it about how all these things fit together that really engages you in what you get to do?
Well, I think there's a tension in the way we think about knowledge between disciplinary thinking and holistic thinking. And some people probably tend more towards disciplinary thinking, where they become complete masters of a particular intellectual approach, a set of assumptions, but also a set of common texts and practices. Other people are more instinctively drawn towards seeing connections and emphasizing breadth. I think I'm probably one of the latter. I think that's stood me in good stead in general, but it also allows some helpful interventions at this stage, because in so many of the disciplines of Western intellectual life, the dog that didn't bark, or the missing term or something, is now religion. So many places in our universities are doing outstanding jobs of teaching Shakespeare's plays, the history of the Middle Ages or of late antiquity or whatever. The expertise is not joined up with whatever other expertise there is in religion, such that one doesn't get whatever the religious element is in those other subjects. So for me, something like the encyclopedia, but as you rightly say, the other things I've done in my career as well, are ways of putting God back in those pictures, putting people of the past and of our own time and their connection to God back into the study of the humanities.
Yeah, how do we come to a deeper understanding of theology, of the things that we believe, that we confess in church every Sunday? How do we come to a deeper understanding of those things when we start to understand the connections between all of these different facets, all of these things that God has given us? How does that really help us to deepen that theological understanding?
Well, there's a lot of possible answers. I think of things that Luther said and wrote about how the word works on us. Mm-hmm. So when a pastor preaches the word, it comes to us, but how does it affect us? Well, one of the ways it can do so is by building a picture in our hearts, so to mm-hmm. speak. So we come to see things in a way that we wouldn't have on our own. And that, to me, licenses that reality licenses a lot of different artistic approaches and a lot of different engagements with everything else. Because often when we see a painting of the crucifixion, we are not just, it's not that we're learning something new about God in perhaps the strictest sense, but what we are seeing is how the word of God worked in someone else's heart. It's the picture that preached word made on someone else's mind, and which then is reflected in the art that he or she made. And that, by giving us the perspective of our fellow humans, can give us new insight, even if it's just experiential insight or emotional insight, into what we might already know intellectually, or at least have available to know intellectually.
Yes. Where can people find more information about the St. Andrew's Encyclopedia of Theology and the other projects that you get to work on?
Well, the St. Andrew's Encyclopedia of Theology is completely available without any login or restriction of any kind at www.saet.com. So that's St. Andrew's Encyclopedia of Theology. Of course, Googling will also bring it up. the Sacred Landscapes Project you can find at sacredlandscapes.org. So I'm committed as much as I can be to open scholarship and to making things available freely. So by all means, have a look online and see those things. The Arianism book was published by Fortress last year, 2025. Arianism Revisited. Those are the best places to look, I think.
Okay, fantastic. We will link those in the show notes too for people to find. It's been a delight having a conversation with you today. I'm so glad you could join us in studio.
Thank you very much for having me.
Dr. Brendan Wolf, Principal Editor of the St. Andrews Encyclopedia of Theology. You've been listening to The Coffee Hour. I'm Sarah Golseth.
The Coffee Hour with Andy and Sarah is a production of KFUO. To support The Coffee Hour and KFUO Radio, visit KFUO.org. You can also text KFUO to 41444 or send an email to gifts@KFUO.org. And you can call us at 800-844-0524. KFUO. Christ for you, anytime, anywhere.